Missing Musher and Talkeetna resident Melanie Gould is found alive after an intense two-week search. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council delays final action on Bering Sea chum bycatch.
We may have the ability to do something that is more targeted and does more to conserve Western Alaska stocks, and that's an important goal.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
State voting district boundaries have changed so substantially under the new map drawn by the Alaska Redistricting Board that every state senator but one will face election next year, even though many were not scheduled for elections until 2014. An election schedule for the senators was approved today by the board. Under the plan, only Senator Dennis Egan, a Juneau Democrat, will not face election in 2012. Egan's district includes nearly 87% of the same population as was there in 2010. Nine other senators who didn't face election until 2014 included at most 55% of the original population. The board approved an election schedule for senators this morning. Under state law, half the senators run for election every 2 years. To keep that schedule, 9 of the 19 on the ballot in 2012 will run for 2-year terms. Missing Talkeetna resident and former Iditarod musher Melanie Gould was found alive and unharmed on Saturday. Local Talkeetna residents launched a search after the troopers' official ground search halted on Thursday. The local residents said they found her close to Cantwell, unharmed but cold and tired. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters said that Gould contacted them on Saturday. Gould was transported to Matsu Regional Hospital Saturday afternoon. The Facebook site dedicated to finding her announced Saturday afternoon that she was found alive and unharmed, and later that day it was taken offline. A spokesperson for the family said they are eternally grateful for all the assistance they received from Talkeetna residents, that Gould is in good care, and a formal statement will most likely be made later this week. Her family has traveled to be with her. Gould was reported missing after she didn't show up to work on Tuesday, May 31st. A search was launched, and on Saturday, June 4th, Alaska State Troopers found her truck about 18 miles from Cantwell on the Denali Highway. From there, an intense ground and air search was initiated. Dozens of individuals and search dogs were involved in the search. The official search was called off 10 days after she went missing. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council voted Saturday to delay the initial review of chum salmon bycatch reduction alternatives in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. It does not set a date for the review, but the council plans to meet in September and December of this year. They also set a hard cap in the Gulf of Alaska pollock fishery. From Kanawem and Nome, Lorelei Kanin has the story.
This weekend in Nome, the council unanimously passed a resolution brought forward by Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell. The original review included 4 alternatives to curb chum bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. Campbell's motion did away with a triggered closure program and created a new alternative, incorporating monthly closure options to the current rolling hotspot program. Campbell pointed out that genetic work shows Western Alaska stocks are caught in greater proportion during the early part of the season.
After that August 1st date, it's a smaller proportion that's Western Alaska bound. So by adding some options that allow the council to look at that, we may have the ability to do something that is more targeted and does more to conserve Western Alaska stocks, and that's an important goal.
The motion also calls for an expanded discussion of Norton Sound salmon fisheries by district. It also asks research staff to describe possible impacts to specific stocks given the limitation of stock identification information. The council took more than 7 hours of public testimony before hearing the motion. Joe Garney from Tiller said the diminished chum runs are threatening the lifestyles of many.
This salmon sustained a lifestyle for us in the Port Clarence District for thousands and thousands of years, enabled us to have a life there. And before my very eyes, in my generation, in these short last few years, I have seen this lifestyle disappear. We're at the last thread of it.
Anthropologist for Kawerak, the regional nonprofit, Julie Raymond Jacobian, was critical of the council's approach to tribal consultation. She said the limited consultation has affected the process.
I think one of the reasons you're hearing people really put their fist down and say they want a low cap and it's something that's not in the alternatives is because, like I said, they were not involved in the development of that. And if consultation had begun at an earlier date, I know that you'd be hearing different things from tribes today.
And in regards to the Gulf of Alaska Chinook bycatch issue, the council did take final action. Again, Commissioner Campbell made the motion in yesterday's meeting to set the Gulf of Alaska bycatch to 22,500 Chinook salmon. After deliberation, the council voted to set the cap at 25,000. There was a bit of a struggle between the two numbers on the table, and the discussion came down to balance. The council is obligated to minimize bycatch in the federal fisheries. They're also obligated to ensure optimum yield in those fisheries, in this case, the pollock fishery. Commissioner Campbell voted with the majority in instating the 25,000 hard cap.
It's a very significant step forward. It's a hard cap that is going to control salmon bycatch in the pollock fishery in the Gulf. And so ultimately, I thought that taking that step forward and getting that cap in place was more important than whether there was a 2,500 fish difference between the cap that I had proposed and the cap that the council settled on.
During deliberation and defending the proposed 22,500 hard cap measure, Commissioner Campbell said the council needs to treat salmon users equally with the pollock industry.
Because they don't perhaps spend as much time with salmon fishermen, I just wanted to remind the council that we do have an obligation to look out for and speak up for the salmon fishermen. And I think that the meeting here in Nome was a very good chance for the council to spend some time with people who are very dependent on salmon, and that I hope was a good reminder for council members as well.
The Gulf of Alaska fishery hit a historical high of Chinook bycatch last season at 51,000 fish. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
The effort by a handful of organizations to provide more and better information to the commercial fishing fleets, processors, and other stakeholders in Bristol Bay should get a boost in the next few days as the Port Moeller test fishery gets ramped up. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The fishery is under the direction of the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute, which is a subsidiary of the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. This year, the test fishery will feature two vessels. The core component of the test fishery will be the vessel Pandelis that will be fishing a multi-mesh 200-fathom gill net over seven stations well offshore of Port Moeller. BBSRI then puts together a daily index number that is sent out to the stakeholders with the hope that it gives some indication of the abundance of sockeye headed to the bay. Michael Link is the chief scientist with BBSRI, and he confirms that again this year, the test fishery will feature a second vessel that will be conducting more extensive testing of the effectiveness of the modeling, science, and techniques used in the test fishery.
Or there may be some factors that affect the catch rate, like tide, stage, sea state, time of year, time of day, that we can actually account for. If those affect the catch rates in a predictable manner, maybe there's some of these covariates that we can factor in and better estimate abundance.
The fishing area for the Port Moeller test fishery starts 30 miles offshore, and they fish seven stations that are 10 miles apart. However, Link says they fish about four to five stations in any given day. The major story that developed last year was in the Igigik district, where the sockeye harvest was 4.9 million fish, which was 45% less than the preseason forecast. Michael Link asserts there were red flag warnings in the data coming from the Port Moeller test fishery.
You know, overlaid on that story is just a growing confidence in the representativeness of the samples out there. So 3 years ago, none of us would have been very bold in saying that. With each accumulating year of track record with the genetics and in subsequent inshore performance, everybody gets just a little bit more confidence that those signals are real.
The usefulness of the Port Mueller test fishery is that it can give an indication of the makeup of the sockeye resource that is between 6 to 8 days away from the inshore districts in Bristol Bay. Something new this year will be a series of 6 sonar units that will be placed on the bottom of the ocean to monitor the water column. Michael Link says the sonar units will likely be placed at station number 6.
Our goal with the sonar is to develop an independent estimate of what's really happening there, when the fish push, how fast they swim as a function of the time of day and tide stage, and then look at how efficient the net is relative to those. So we will be deploying these sonar units. We did a feasibility study with them last year with just a few units, and we were able to see fish up near the surface.
Link notes that the new sonar units on the bottom of the ocean will have to be retrieved post-season and the data removed from the units before any analysis can begin. Funding and support for the Port Mueller test fishery comes from a variety of sources, including the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Dillingham. I'm Mike Mason.
A federal judge has appointed a public defender in case the government decides to retry former Wasilla area state representative, Republican Vic Coring. The Anchorage Daily News reports Coring told U.S. Magistrate Judge John Roberts that he is broke and had to borrow a vehicle and $40 to get to today's hearing. He also told the judge he has less than $1 in 4 combined bank accounts. Coring was convicted in 2007 of conspiracy to commit extortion, attempted extortion, and bribery, and sentenced to 3.5 years in prison. He was released in 2009 while his case underwent further review. A 3-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in March ordered a new trial after finding prosecutors withheld information that could have been favorable to the defense. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitka school kids get close up with an orca carcass.
Oh, it just got me in the eye. Ew, the juice. Ew.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
4 people are unhurt after a Universal Airlines plane crash-landed in Cold Bay yesterday. The plane, a DC-6, landed without landing gear extended. FAA officials say the plane was substantially damaged. The runway was closed for several hours after the crash. The DC-6 was in Cold Bay to pick up commercially caught salmon. The state of Alaska must still release another batch of emails from Sarah Palin's time as governor, but don't expect them anytime soon. Somewhat lost in the hubbub over Friday's release of thousands of pages of emails was the fact that it only covered the first 21 months of the Palin administration. Several news outlets have requested records from the rest of her time in office, but Assistant Attorney General Dave Jones says the governor's office has yet to send them to the Department of Law for review.
So we don't know yet how many email messages will be involved, and therefore won't be able to predict how long it might take to review them and get them out.
State Administrative Services Director Linda Perez also isn't sure how long it will take to release the next batch of emails, which will cover October 1, 2008, through Palin's resignation on July 26, 2009. Perez says news outlets began requesting the additional records in the last 6 months. The state came under fire for taking 2.5 years to process Friday's release, but Jones says it takes time to review the emails for privileged information, which he says cannot be done electronically.
I know from personal experience in looking at these documents that it would be very difficult to do a thorough privilege review electronically, just to run some searches and come up with everything that is confidential.
The next email release will actually be the 4th document dump related to Palin's time as governor. Last year, the state released about 3,000 pages of Todd Palin's emails, showing the hands-on role he played in state government. Some emails related to the so-called Troopergate investigation have also been released. Several news organizations have posted all the Palin emails released to date on the web. The World Ice Carving Exhibitors Association is close to purchasing a new venue for the annual Ice Art Championships and Kids Park in Fairbanks. The nonprofit group, better known as Ice Alaska, is buying 25 acres off the Johansson Expressway for $2.3 million. The property is near where the group has leased Alaska Railroad land for 22 years. The organization unsuccessfully tried to work a deal to buy the railroad acreage, and Ice Alaska President Dick Brickley says ownership is the biggest advantage of the new site.
Now, everything that we do will be essentially permanent. We won't have to jerry-rig it or anything like this. We'll own the ground so we can do live web feeds. Our internet services will be great. The telephone people are working with us. We'll be able to put in the underground power, everything that just makes it a world-class site.
Ice Alaska is putting together the land deal with $800,000 from an organization board member and $1.5 million in state grant money. Work has already begun to dismantle and move Ice Alaska's headquarters and other infrastructure to the new venue. The new site has a bigger pond for ice harvesting and a mix of shaded and open areas for ice sculptures. A new government report outlines 33 recommendations for creating new jobs in the forest products, seafood, visitor, and renewable energy industries in Southeast Alaska. The recommendations were developed by four groups of industry, government, and stakeholder representatives called cluster groups. The report is part of an ongoing Department of Agriculture strategy called the Transition Framework, aimed at diversifying the economy in the region. KFSK's Joe Viknicki reports.
The action initiatives range from developing land and water trails between the communities of Southeast to restoring wild salmon habitat and boosting hatchery salmon enhancement. They also include simplifying the process for small timber sales for mills on Prince of Wales Island. The U.S. Forest Service's regional forester Beth Pendleton said the government will have a role in the job creation initiatives.
The Forest Service Rural Development Farm Services Agency, we all have some programs, everything from short-term loans to grant programs, but the success will really be, I think, driven by the private sector with support of the federal, state, and other partners.
Other recommendations for the forest products industry include establishment of congressionally designated timberlands, use of young growth trees for cabin construction, and substituting biomass energy for diesel consumption in Southeast communities. The list of initiatives for the ocean products industry recommends a sea otter management program in the region. It also lists generating more of a shipbuilding and repair workforce, bolstering marine infrastructure, and use of fish waste for fertilizer or fuel. Danny Constantine with the USDA Farm Services Agency saw opportunities with loan programs that could help create jobs in shellfish farming.
We could work together with the state as well as with our sister agencies at USDA with rural development to help support some of the strategies for job creation around the growing mariculture industry.
Among the visitor industry recommendations are increased guide access to national forest land, promotion of multi-community visitor packages, and a tourism course with the University of Alaska Southeast. And in the renewable energy category, initiatives include exploring a connection to the North American power grid, a revolving loan fund for energy projects, and legislation to allow net metering or credit for renewable energy sold back to utilities from a private source. The government agencies contracted with the Juneau Economic Development Council to complete the report, along with a map of assets in Southeast completed last winter. Both phases of the report cost $235,000. Brian Holst, executive director of the JEDC, said the next step is implementing the recommendations.
By strengthening these industries, we will strengthen the economy in our region.
And Lindsay Ketchell is executive director with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. She also participated in some of the group meetings.
You know, a little disappointed in the renewable energy that they're only going to focus in on biomass energy. We did participate in that cluster, and we feel that there's great opportunity for salmon-friendly hydro projects, and that really if you're going to get at some of these rural economies being able to be economically viable, they've got to get off diesel and they've got to have more viable charges for their electricity to make any kind of economic development happen.
The Departments of Agriculture and Commerce are developing a strategic economic investment plan for funding some of the initiatives. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The big wildfire north of Fairbanks has calmed down with recent showery cool weather. The Hastings fire has been burning for 2 weeks, but its growth has slowed in recent days. Information Officer Sarah Sarlow says weather conditions have varied across the more than 23,000-acre burn area.
The Hastings fire is currently 11 miles across from west to east, so that's a large area. These last couple days with the thundercells that have came through, some areas have received rain and left others, and ironically, some of the critical areas without getting rain. Last night, though, we did get a wetting rain across the full fire perimeter.
Sarlow says the wet weather is allowing hand crews to work the fire perimeter directly in areas where subdivisions could be threatened if things dry out again. Sarlow says the fire remains between the Chattanooga River on the south and Washington Creek to the north. Weather has also helped crews working the 58,000-acre East Volkmar fire northeast of Delta Junction. There are six other staffed wildfires in the state. A group of students in Sitka is working on an orca skeleton that was recovered near Sitka in March. They're learning about the messy work that goes into preparing those remains for display in the Sitka Sound Science Center. KCAW's Emily Bender checked in with the class and brings us this report.
I arrived at the Sitka Sound Science Center, where scientist Shannon Adkinson was showing me the first step in making an orca skeleton.
I'm happy to show you where we're cooking up bones if you want. You won't get.
We go down and stop in front of two large steel tanks with crab boilers flaming underneath.
Vertebrae from it, and when I open this up, it'll get a tiny bit stronger. So if you're not going to like that, you might want to step back. So basically, I'm taking the cover off this other back and just looking to see the stage of this one. This one's pretty good.
Yeah, that is ripe.
So this, just if you have a peek, it's almost like whale soup. And see how we're cooking that up, and it's much the way you would make a turkey soup after Thanksgiving, and you can see all the vertebrae there starting to come apart.
It looks like a giant rack of ribs.
That's exactly what it is, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Rack of orca instead of rack of lamb. So what we do is, once all of this is pretty much loosened up off the bones, what the students are doing then is they go and scrape off all of the soft tissue, which we end up throwing away. And then once they've done their part, then we'll take over again and we'll do a chemical treatment of the bones, and that'll make them all nice and white, and then no one will believe they ever looked like this.
When the orca carcass was found, Atkinson brought it here to teach kids about science.
When we were told that there was a dead killer whale on the beach on Kruzoff Island in March, we jumped on the opportunity to participate in the necropsy and to harvest all the bones. And so we have a complete skeleton of a young killer whale.
Students at the center's summer science camp are about to clean the orca's 50-pound cranium.
Okay, everyone needs gloves. So if you do not have a pair of gloves, please right now get gloves, the purple ones.
It's sitting in a large sink of water, and it takes three adults to move it onto the large steel table where kids are waiting. It's been boiled, just like the rest of the bones. Later, it's going to be some lucky kid's job to reach inside the small opening of the back of the skull and pull out the brain.
You know, this is the part that the kids tend to like. They tend to have an affinity for gross things.
With the toothbrushes, I have some other picks and things.
I'm expecting the room full of middle schoolers to be squeamish once they get down to it. But as soon as the smelly chunks of whale flippers, the jaw and vertebrae hit the tables in front of them, they tear into it like it's no big deal.
I'm thinking probably at the teeth because of...
But then one of them has a little mishap.
Oh, it just got me in the eye. Ew.
What just got you in the eye?
The juice. Oh. Ew.
This looks like it's pretty dirty work.
It is dirty work. I can see why scientists have fun with this.
This isn't your average science class. Atkinson says many kids aren't lucky enough to have such a cool specimen to learn from.
Yeah, these kids are lucky. This science camp is exposing them to a lot of neat things between the red tide last week and an orca skull this week. You can't ask for a whole lot more in terms of a kid's science education.
Okay, so, go ahead very gently.
Now it's time for the part I have been dreading. But the kids are so excited to see the whale brains, they squeeze around the table to watch.
Okay. I'm feeling the brain, and it feels like my homemade pesto.
Okay, actually, homemade pesto.
It looks like cat food.
It's made up of...
After scrubbing and carefully removing all the whale tissue, the bones will be soaked for about 3 weeks to remove the remaining oil in the bones.
You can use them to help pull the tissue out from around each tooth.
Then, later in the summer, a group of undergraduates will start piecing the skeleton back together. Finally, at the end of this long process, the completed orca skeleton will be on display at the Sitka Sound Science Center.
We hope to have the skeleton articulated to unveil for Alaska Day.
Atkinson says this will be 1 in 5 completed orca skeletons in the United States, since they are rarely found intact. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Bender.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Sue Dio in Talkeetna, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Bender in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.